Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Mark Ames, who takes a critical look at charges that the Russian government hacked Democratic Party and Clinton campaign emails with the goal of interfering in the outcome of the U.S. presidential election. Bill Fletcher Jr., who discusses the grotesque U.S. presidential campaign and effective post-election strategies for the nation's progressive movement. And former inmate Arlinda Trey Johns, who talks about her experience serving 8 years in prison and her current goal of becoming an attorney and advocating for criminal justice reform. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon sent a confidential letter to the UN Security Council in early October complaining that South Sudan is undermining its commitment to accept the deployment of 4,000 UN peacekeepers to the war-torn East African nation. South Sudan, founded in 2011, is in the midst of a 3-year civil war where over the summer 200,000 people fled their homes during a new round of fighting as high-level peace negotiations got underway. The Security Council is now considering imposing an arms embargo against South Sudan for its failure to honor its pledge to accept the new peacekeepers. In recent months, top UN officials and UN installations have come under attack by government soldiers, putting vital humanitarian work at risk. The UN Security Council wants to authorize peacekeepers to defend the airport and other critical infrastructure, but opposition to increasing the number of UN peacekeepers has grown. One of President Salva Kiir's top advisors warned this summer that the deployment of UN troops would constitute a declaration of war and invasion of the country, jeopardizing future peacekeeping. A leading moderate Uyghur activist, Ilham Todi, who is serving a life sentence in China, was awarded the prestigious Swiss-based Martine Ahnals Prize for Human Rights on October 11th. Todi, known as China's Mandela, was convicted of separatism in a Xinjiang court in a region rife with ethnic conflict between the Han Chinese majority and Muslim Uyghur minority population. The Martine Ahnals Foundation praised Todi for rejecting separatism and violence and instead working towards reconciliation based on respect for Uyghur culture, which has for decades been subjected to religious, cultural, and political repression. The decision to honor Ilham Todi is likely to spark an angry response from Beijing. Nicholas Bekelin, Amnesty International's East Asia director, said, by arresting Todi, Beijing betrayed its fear that discussions of any kind about the situation of Uyghurs in China would inevitably bring attention to the extraordinarily repressive policies under which they live. A month before Election Day, Maricopa County, Arizona, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, whose officers patrol Greater Phoenix, was charged with criminal contempt of court for refusing to follow a court order to halt immigration sweeps. In 2011, U.S. Federal District Judge Murray Snow ordered Arpaio to end police stops of individuals based solely on their immigration status. The U.S. Justice Department is also considering an obstruction of justice charge against Arpaio over the sheriff's refusal to turn over 50 computer hard disks relating to an informant in Seattle who was hired by the sheriff's attorneys to investigate Judge Snow's wife. Arpaio, who is 84 and running for his 7th term as sheriff, called the indictment a political attack. The sheriff, a supporter of Donald Trump and an early backer of his birther movement, insisted that he was going to fight back and expected to be reelected. Recent polls show Arpaio trailing Democrat Paul Panzone by 10 percentage points. In recent years, the right-wing sheriff has lost popularity after a wave of investigations and political stunts, such as forming a citizen posse to find Obama's birth certificate. Still, Arpaio has a $12 million political war chest that he's using to campaign hard to win re-election in November. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After weeks of similar accusations made by Hillary Clinton's campaign, the Obama administration publicly charged that the Russian government had stolen and then leaked emails that were taken from the Democratic National Committee and Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta. In a statement released on October 7th, James Clapper Jr., director of National Intelligence, said Russia had given the emails to WikiLeaks and other websites that were intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. For months now, government officials had pointed fingers at an individual who goes by the online name Guccifer 2.0, who they say is associated with Russian intelligence and was responsible for the hacking of U.S. emails. Following the official statement, Vice President Joe Biden went a step further by asserting in a TV interview that the U.S. is now working on plans to covertly retaliate against the Russian cyber attacks. The escalation of hostile rhetoric between Washington and Moscow over the hacked emails follows unsuccessful U.S.-Russian diplomatic efforts to negotiate a ceasefire in the besieged Syrian city of Aleppo, friction over Moscow's 2014 annexation of Crimea, and the Kremlin-backed rebel war in eastern Ukraine. Your reporter spoke with journalist and author Mark Ames, a founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly The Exile. Here, Ames, who's lived and worked in Russia on and off for 14 years, explains why he's skeptical about widely accepted claims that the Russian government is responsible for the hacks of DNC and Hillary Clinton campaign emails, and the danger he sees of a developing new Cold War.
We're ramping up a very serious and potentially dangerous Cold War over these accusations, so I want actual evidence. So far, the evidence I've seen that everyone was waving around was apparently in the metadata on some of these hacks. Somebody called himself in Cyrillic letters, that is in the Russian alphabet. So it went by the name Felix Edmundovich, which is the name and patronym of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Cheka, which became the KGB. Now, that being used as evidence that that was actually a GRU, a Russian military intelligence agent, because he used as his nickname the founder of the Cheka, is to me so absurd. It would be like an American spy mole, you know, mulling his way into North Korea and using as the super secret name Alan Dulles. Or something, you know. I mean, it's
Alan Dulles being the founder of the CIA, right?
Yeah, or one of the early directors and co-founders. Yeah, you have to know nothing about Russia to think that that is a plausible piece of evidence. I have a lot of questions too. I mean, according to the timelines, according to these stories in various major newspapers, the FBI first noticed the hacks in June of 2015. And first told the DNC 2 months later. So now if the Russians are trying to make sure that Hillary Clinton doesn't win, if this is not a Clinton campaign strategy to deflect from what's actually in the emails and try and make it seem like you're a traitor if you report them, if the Russians were actually trying to keep her out and they started hacking 6 months, 7 months before the first caucuses, why didn't they do a single thing to help Bernie Sanders ever? Why didn't they do anything up through, you know, April when it was still a contested primary, even up to early May, to help Bernie Sanders? This is a guy who spent his honeymoon in Soviet Russia in a banya with Soviet local officials in Yaroslavl. Obviously, this is the guy you'd want to help. Why would you wait till Donald Trump, this crazy buffoon? You know, she runs against him, the only person she can probably beat on the Republican side. So none of this just makes any sense to me.
What's your view of the concern by a growing number of people here in the United States that there's a new serious Cold War brewing between the United States and Russia, given the charges and countercharges about interference in the U.S. election by Moscow, given the history of tensions with Moscow over the annexation of Crimea and the border war in Ukraine? And then, of course, you've got the failed diplomacy to reach a ceasefire in Syria or to end that horrible war. What are your concerns about a new Cold War?
Oh, I think it's potentially very serious. I mean, I get that part of this heating up, this sort of new Cold War thing on the Clinton side and Clinton supporters is to campaigns and politics are a rough business, and I get that. But I also think it's a genuine window into what to expect in the future. I'm assuming Hillary Clinton's going to win, and I'm assuming that this is not going to be the end of this. I'm assuming that this is going to be what we have to look forward to for the next 8 years, and very, very tense relations with the Russians. And you know, I find it extremely dangerous. I find it extremely dangerous because it seems like there's no strong voice pushing back against it. Certainly within the establishment, there's nobody pushing back. Nobody wants to be seen, for obvious reasons, as a, you know, defender of Vladimir Putin. It's not like, I mean, the Soviets at least stood for equality, equality of incomes, gender equality, and different things like that, at least on paper. You know, what does the Kremlin stand for? This is not a, it's a conservative, very conservative, neoliberal, conservative regime. So I don't think there's any pushback, and I think it's unleashing a lot of really crazy forces in this country. You know, revanchist cold warriors who never went away. I've seen that all my time out in Russia and since coming back.
Who, in your mind, are the main beneficiaries if the U.S. and Russia reignite a new cold war?
The defense industry and the military-industrial complex, the military intelligence complex, no doubt about it. There was a push by Hagel shortly before he was put into retirement to enact major cuts in 2014. Go back and, you know, reread the articles about it. The military was going to be cut down to its smallest size since the end of World War II, or since before World War II. You know, there were going to be serious cuts, and now that's over. And frankly, it helps the Russians too. I mean, I can tell you the Russian, you know, their pride was very wounded by their experience under Yeltsin. The they were very humiliating years. They were essentially colonized and run from outside, and they didn't matter, and they were considered a joke. And there are people in the Kremlin who, I think, I think Putin even said this, they like the fact that we talk about them as if they count and as if they're a menace and a rival. They like mattering, number one. Number two, it's good for their defense industries. But that said, you know, their defense budget, I think in the last 2 years, is in the $65 billion range. Ours is about $600 billion. And because of their economy has been hurting, the budgets for the next 3 years, they're cutting their military 6% per year, according to the published reports. So I'd say cold warriors on both sides, military industrial complex on both sides, and then neocons in general. They love this. The neocons in Washington absolutely love this. They feel relevant again.
That was journalist and author Mark Ames, a founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile. Find more analysis on the escalation of U.S.-Russian tensions by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The assertion that the 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign is one of the most grotesque and bizarre political contests in recent American history is one of few points of agreement among an increasingly polarized electorate. And according to public opinion polls, the two candidates vying for the White House are the most unpopular political figures seen over the last 30 years. Apart from the earlier personal insults hurled by GOP nominee Donald Trump against his Republican rivals in the primary campaign, the more recent release of a videotape of the billionaire real estate mogul bragging about how he had sexually assaulted women was followed by at least 10 women who came forward to accuse Trump of similar attacks. However, with much of the media focus on the allegations of sexual misconduct by Trump and his campaign's counterattack targeting Bill Clinton's behavior in the 1990s, there's very little discussion of substantive issues important to most voters. One disturbing aspect of the campaign that is too often overlooked is Mr. Trump's blatant appeal to racial hatred, xenophobia, and misogyny. Frightening to many political observers is the white supremacists and other so-called alt-right racist groups that have been attracted to and energized by the Trump campaign. Your reporter spoke with Bill Fletcher Jr., a former president of TransAfrica Forum, past vice president for International Trade Union Development Programs at the AFL-CIO, and an editorial board member of BlackCommentator.com. Here he discusses his concerns about the demons unleashed in the 2016 campaign and effective strategies he proposes for the progressive movement after the November 8th election.
Trump and his surrogates are playing with fire. And whether or not they understand the full ramifications of what they're doing is secondary, because they're building off of a flame that has been fueled since 1948 in one way or another by incredibly racist and opportunist forces in this country. And what has happened is that there are elements in the Republican Party that, particularly beginning in 64 and then certainly in 68, believed that they could tap into and harness the power of a right-wing populist movement, and that they could click it on and off as they needed it to. And the problem is, right-wing populist movements do not lend themselves to being clicked on and off. When they are ignited, they start to take on a life of their own. But the Republican establishment really thought that they could control this. And what Trump has done is he's tapped into various kinds of angers, and I use that in a plural sense, that exist out there. It is a revolt against the future and a fear of everything. It's that combination. And that is what makes this scary, because then you add on to that guns. So in the throughout the course of this primary season, and particularly since Trump got the nomination, he's been basically flirting with the possibility of something that comes very close to an armed insurrection. He flirted with the issue of an assassination of Hillary Clinton. And now he's been increasingly talking about that the election might be stolen and that something will need to be done about that. And then you have his surrogates that suggest that that something might need to be an armed action. So that makes this very, very scary. And it's why progressives need to be on alert. We need to make sure that these elections, that the voters are protected, that voter suppression is not permitted, that voter intimidation is not permitted, and we're going to have to stand firm, regardless of what the right wing does or tries.
When you look at the progressive movement that came out of the primaries with Bernie Sanders really articulating for the first time in many decades an agenda that was quite popular among Democrats and a good cross-section of people across the country, have you taken some hope from that larger coalition of progressive interest groups can come together to make a difference in the coming years in U.S. politics?
I think that Sanders could have won the nomination had he early on run to win from the very beginning and situated himself much more among communities of color. I think that he made terrible strategic mistake in the beginning, both by not clearly running to win, but more running to pressure Hillary. But the other thing was more serious, which is that he doesn't get the centrality of race in the United States, and he doesn't get the particular significance, certainly in the Democratic Party, of the African-American and Latino electorate, and increasingly Asians. And I think it was a strategic mistake, because I actually think that he could have captured the nomination. Now, whether he could have won or not, I don't know, because I think had Sanders gotten the nomination, there would have been red baiting, the likes of which we haven't seen in a very long time. One never knows and how people would react to that. But the other thing that was marvelous was the mobilization of so many younger people. So here's what I would say. After November, no matter who wins, for progressives to go forward, there will need to be a state-by-state strategy that aims at fighting for power. It cannot be, let's go back home and wait for 4 years, even 2 years, and then do something. It's got to be in early 2017, we need to start going in every state, bringing together the various strands of the progressive movement that are willing to work inside and outside of the Democratic Party.
That was author and activist Bill Fletcher, Jr., a former president of TransAfrica Forum and past vice president for International Trade Union Development Programs at the AFL-CIO. Find links to more analysis and commentary from Fletcher and others by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 23rd, the National Council of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls held a conference titled Real Women, Real Voices at Yale University Law School in New Haven, Connecticut. Panelists included women who had served years in state and federal prisons, many for nonviolent drug-related offenses. Two of the panels featured remote interviews with women who were still incarcerated. Family members of individuals who had been or are still in prison participated as well. Several of the speakers were women who had recently been pardoned by President Obama in a White House initiative that has committed to reduce the sentences of more than 700 individuals convicted of drug-related nonviolent offenses. One of the women speaking at the conference was Arlinda Trey Johns, who goes by the name of Trey. She described how, as a young woman with responsibility for raising her siblings' 7 children plus a child of her own, she was convicted on drug sales charges and writing a bad check for the purchase of school supplies. Trey served 8 years in prison. Since her release, she's been working with the Council of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls and plans to attend law school with the goal of advocating for criminal justice reform. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Johns about her experience in the criminal justice system and her plans for the future.
I sold $450 worth of drugs because I had 6 kids in school and 2 in daycare. I took the judge receipts from Walmart for protractors and crayons and stuff like that, and he allowed me to stay out on bond to complete my last semester of school. And 5 days after I graduated, on the dean's list and the honor roll, he sentenced me to 13 years in federal prison for less than $500 worth of drugs.
And where did you serve?
I wasn't the most compliant inmate because I wasn't happy. So I was at Greenville, Illinois, Hazleton, West Virginia, Waseca, Minnesota, Pekin, Illinois, and Danbury, Connecticut.
And these are all federal prisons?
Yes, these are all federal prisons.
How does it feel to you to know that you spent years in prison for a pretty minor offense? It's almost like stealing bread to feed your family.
Right.
And people, you know, who have committed all kinds of horrendous crimes, you know, rapes and murders and illegally gotten gains of millions of dollars, either don't go to prison at all or serve shorter sentences.
It's disheartening because when you lock up a mother, especially with a small child, you basically destroy the fiber of that family. You know, and if you don't have a father figure in the home or whatever, then, you know, you leave those children to be raised by grandmothers and things like that. But when I sat and I seen people come in and they stolen millions and millions of dollars and destroy people's lives and their kids' college funds, and they get 4 years and 5 years, it's very disheartening, you know, to sit somewhere for 10 years because you did something that any person would do. You help children. That's what you do for children. So it was just, it's still unbelievable. I'm still waiting on somebody to tell me I was on candy camera.
So when did you get out?
I got out the first time, actually, in 2011. I got out August 2nd, 2011. And I got employed August 4th. At my second year out of prison, I was making $62,000 a year as an engineer at Continental Tire.
And then you said you got out for the first time?
My mother had a stroke last year in 2015, and I went to Chicago because I live in southern Illinois at the time, and I went to Chicago to see about my mom, and my probation officer violated me for leaving the district without permission, and they put me back in prison for 4 months after I had been out for 3.5 years.
Oh, God. So did you lose your job?
I lost my job. I lost my house. I lost my car. I had just purchased a $169,000 house. It was my first house I ever bought. I lost my job, my house, my car. I lost everything.
Tell me about where things are for you now.
Well, now my son just graduated high school. He's 19. He's gone, so I'm free. And I've been able to be a instrumental part of the movement. Over the last month, I've traveled from North Carolina to Chicago, New Orleans, California, Washington, D.C., you name it, I've been there. And it's now my dedication is to making sure another woman doesn't lose her child for nothing.
So what's your goal now?
I have a waiver to take the LSAT on December 6th at the University of Tennessee. And I also have a waiver to apply for law school for free in Hawaii and Villanova.
You seem to have quite a bit of drive and commitment. So what do you want to do going to law school? What would be your desired outcome?
To have oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court dismantling the conspiracy law altogether. It's an illegal law. I mean, if you had 13 seconds of law school training, you know the conspiracy law is illegal.
Can you explain that a minute? Why a little bit? Why is it illegal?
One of the things that jump out at me as being illegal is it conspiracy. It means you conspire with one or more persons to commit a crime. But in the federal system, they will convict one person of conspiracy. And that's impossible because if you're conspiring, you're conspiring with. So I can't do it by myself. But you have people serving 25 and 30 years for conspiring with themselves. I want to get rid of the conspiracy law before I die.
That was former inmate Arlinda Trey Johns with the National Council of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. For more information on the council and other resources for prisoners returning to the community, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.